The following content is provided by MIT OpenCourseWare under a Creative Commons license. Additional information about our license and MIT OpenCourseWare in general is available at ocw.mit.edu.
These were the last questions we dealt with. Are there any questions on this? Some of the things on hierarchy, Lawrence has had a tendency more than Tinbergen to simplify it a little bit and by studying some of the very clear-cut fixed action patterns of geese and other birds. He himself understood perfectly in observing mammals, and he trained a number of students that did a lot of mammalian ethology. But they are more complex systems. The hierarchy is not always easy to understand. There's a lot more orienting involved in many of these things. That's why this question is important to understand. Reflexes of an orienting nature might conceal that the fixed motor pattern underneath is still quite the same from one member of the species to another, in that it is inherited. The degree of inheritance, the fixed action patterns, I would say we tend to underestimate for humans. It goes to such an extent that small behavior patterns are characteristic, say, of many men in one family. This becomes very apparent when you haven't seen somebody in the family, like a nephew of mine I hadn't seen for many years. I had only seen him as a little kid. I saw him then when he was grown up, when I went to visit his mother, who had recently been widowed, the death of my uncle. And I watched him. When I first saw him, I caught sight of him and thought it was my uncle. And I was saying, why did I think that? Well, it was because of pattern of movement that he showed, characteristic way he showed locomotion, that he had inherited. And I recognized it instantly, something in my family. And we don't think of these kinds of details very often, but just to point out to you that fixed action patterns, even these levels of the really small components of behavior, can be inherited. Okay, now, did anybody come up with an answer to this? A goldfish sees a bit of food behind some plants that serve as a barrier to him. And this goldfish aren't supposed to be very smart. And yet, what does the goldfish do? He goes right around. I've seen dogs faced with something behind a fence or a window, and they'll bark and bark and clamor at the fence, and it can take them quite a long time to solve the same kind of problem that the goldfish solves more readily. Why is that? Did anybody understand? Lawrence sees it as quite simple. He says it can be explained as the result of a positive telotaxis directed towards the prey and of a negative pygmotaxis causing the fish to avoid contact with the branches. What does that mean? Can somebody translate that sentence for me? Okay, anybody? You figure it out? Yes.
If the fish sees the barrier, they help it see the food, so to avoid the barrier, but goes on.
Right, but why does he avoid the barrier? The reason he avoids it is because he's got a fixed action pattern. And when something impedes him, he's got a tendency, the positive thigmotaxis. He follows the surface. So it's his natural tendency. The dog stays more fixated on the goal, and he forgets about the means. You see, he's a higher animal, and it messes him up in this case until he gets more practice. The fish is dominated by, he starts swimming towards the goal, but he meets those plants. And it's the natural behavior of the fish to respond to the physical presence, the touching, these things, to go along it, just to swim along it. That dominates his behavior until he's clear of the plants, and then the goal is in front of him and he gets it. Okay? So two fixed action patterns combined to solve that problem for the fish, even though he didn't have to learn to solve it.
Okay. There isn't a reward behind the obstruction, so it will go fish longer to avoid the obstruction?
If he wants to get to the other side for whatever reason, for whatever goal, he'll do that same thing. Okay. So let's talk a little bit about higher behavior in us and higher in the primates. In that section on, it's a section on taxis and reflexes, simple reflex and responses to that give us, keep us oriented in space. And Lawrence immediately moves into a discussion of human thinking. Why is that? Because of all the evidence that spatial orientation, spatial thinking, is very basic to our higher thought processes, and we use that to solve problems. What is insight? Insight. If you solve a problem by insight, how's that different from some other solution to the problem? Can somebody tell me? There's some famous experiments that we can talk about on insight in gorillas and insight in chimpanzees. And similar problems have been given to children at various ages. And the chimp is actually a little better than a very young child, but not better than a child that's, say, by the time he's 7 or 8. Yes? Sorry? Yeah, but so you've got a hard problem. If you solve it by insight rather than by trial and error, what's the difference? It's when you can look at the problem, think about it, okay, whatever that means, and you solve it before you take action. Then you're showing insight. And we do that by our a spatial model. But this is sort of a prior question. What is it about human language that tells us that that's the kind of thing we do? I mean, he could have gone much further than he does there, where he gives examples from language. How we put so many different things that we think about and talk about in terms of space. You know, we talk of things as being higher and lower. In politics, we're to the left or to the right. You know, when we talk about time, we usually translate it into spatial terms. And our language is filled with that. And it's not just one language, all human languages do this. I mean, there are minor differences among languages, of course, in this also, but in every language you find this kind of usage. You should read that again, read his examples, and you can think of many other examples. Think about how you try to solve a problem. When we have creative ideas, how do we do it? We visualize it in space, you know. We manipulate it in our imagination, but that imagination is in spatial terms. How many of you have seen films of the studies of insight learning in gorillas or chimps? Okay, so half of you, maybe. I do have that on videos in my collection at home, so I could try to find that so all of you could see it. But briefly, what do they do? Just give an example. Somebody that's seen it, can you describe it?
Yeah, they just said that they put a brain tank, like,
okay, I left out the orangutan. These have all been done with orangutans also.
Yes. And then they put a box on the side. They put the orangutan in there, and at first, just like throw the tantrum like that, like a little child would get really mad because the food's up there, but they can't reach it. And after, like, the tantrum subsides and they start to clear to think about things, they see that.
Yeah, after he's thrown his tantrum, he becomes quiet for a little while.
Yeah, he starts looking back and forth and realizes that if you move the box and leave the bananas, you can get the bananas.
That's right. Now, when this has been done, it was done first with gorillas on the island of Tenerife by Wolfgang Köhler, I believe. Who came to the University of Chicago and spent most of the later part of his life at the University of Chicago and wrote about some of these studies. He did it with gorillas, and it's been done with chimpanzees. Now, these studies have been analyzed. I think Lawrence is a little too quick about going over them here, because in fact, it takes these animals, some of them never solve it, but in some of them it takes a long, long time. But you can analyze what they're doing. They're using different fixed action patterns about how the spatial world is organized to help them with it. So what are the fixed action patterns? Let's just stick with chimpanzees. Gorillas do very similar things in their habits. Think about what they do if a banana's too high to reach. What would be the first thing they would do? Climb the tree. Okay, but if it's hung from a wire by a human being, so it's not so easily reached, then what did they do? Why would they know that the box is relevant? Why do you think? That's what I would suggest, that they've been in these situations before and they've learned about boxes. But why? What is it in the natural behavior of a chimpanzee or a gorilla that would make them, in their play behavior, play with things like boxes and pile them up? Because the way they did it with the chimp, he couldn't just use one box, as Lawrence described, and bring it over. He had to actually pile boxes on top of each other. I think one of the films I have shows them piling it up, and the first time they try it, it wasn't stable, and it falls down, and then they have to do it again. But they do it. The answer probably is, and this was analyzed by in an article written by Claire Schiller, Peter Schiller's mother, they have a natural behavior of nest building every night. They pile things up and make. So they have a natural tendency to pile things. And some of the things they pile for their nests are fairly sizable chunks of vegetation and so forth. So at least they have the action patterns of piling. And they have the experience, because in their play behavior, they'll do that with anything available. And if there's not much available, but there are these wooden boxes, they will play with them and they will pile them up. Not because they have insight into what piling does, they just do it because it's part of their natural behavior. Okay? But connecting these different action patterns together to solve the problem in the way you just described does take a kind of insight. They have to put it together. And that's something higher animals can do much better The goldfish, you see, we said didn't have to solve that problem by insight. It's a similar kind of problem. It's that what the gorilla or chimp is doing is a kind of detour problem, right? It's finding another way to get to that banana. The goldfish found a way to get, but he simply enacted his, he could have forgotten totally about the food. He was dominated by his positive thigmotaxis, and then once he's around, he sees the food and goes to get it. Okay? So I just want you to see that we don't want to attribute too much to the insight here. Okay? Think about how they're putting their natural behaviors together. And I just wanted you to make note of this in Lawrence. He's really talking about the evolution of the brain, the evolution of the more advanced part of the forebrain. He proposes there had to be the evolution of a higher control center that was sort of superimposed on all these orienting mechanisms that keep us orienting in space. And what he really means is a spatial model. We have a model of the world in us. And some of us, we all have it, and some of us is much more explicit than others. Okay. I am blessed with the ability to actually see that spatial model in my mind. If I close my eyes, I see all of you, I see the position there, I see the doors, one there and one there. And if I walk with my eyes shut, I could get pretty close. Okay, it wouldn't be perfect. Okay. But I find that people that can't see it can still do most of the same thing. We have a very good spatial sense and spatial memories. And now he says higher animals have this. And he says one of the things that we do with it is to prioritize. We don't just have the sense of where everything is. We also can prioritize actions within that space. So then the question I'm asking there is that last question. How do we distinguish higher and lower? See, he says higher animals have this. Well, what is a higher animal? What is a lower animal? I want at least three of you to give me a definition. What's a higher animal?
Higher animals are people more complex decision-making.
More complex in their decision-making, okay.
For example, the goldfish that forgets about the goal and just responds to the thing blocking it from the goal. It's not really considering multiple details. So the time is a lower animal.
Okay. So he solved that problem like a lower animal. He didn't have to weigh his priorities and make a decision. So he's not as complex in his decision making. That's a good, you're sticking with behavior. I like that. Somebody else have a behavioral definition? See, I have a natural tendency to go right to the brain, you know. But Lawrence tries to do it with behavior, but he doesn't really define it here, except in terms of a very postulated mechanism that really is in the brain, of course. How would you do it?
Higher animals can respond instantly to instant information.
To what?
Instant information that changes.
I would say most animals can respond to instant information, which means the responses that are naturally made to changes in the environment. Every animal can do that. In fact, it hasn't been studied in a comparative way enough, responses to novelty. We'll talk about that either by the end of this class or next class. Any other definitions?
So when I was kind of talked about all these orienting mechanisms, probably we wouldn't have that in our animal. The amoeba only has one or two orienting
mechanisms. The amoeba has orienting mechanisms, but he certainly doesn't have a memory, an internal model in his memory. So you see, if you take off from what Lawrence says here, we could probably formulate some definition. It might be very hard to test. But we could formulate or try to formulate a definition of a higher animal in terms of that model that the animal can use. in navigating the world, in thinking about the world, in solving problems in the world. Okay. I thought somebody was going to say, the more they're like us, the higher they are. And yes, you could do that, but then we'd have to admit that they might not be like us, but they might still be higher. We might meet somebody from another galaxy like that. Okay, let's talk about multiple motivations here. E.O. Wilson points out right at the beginning of his famous book on sociobiology, a topic we will study when we finish the Scott book, that we didn't evolve to solve conflicts. Being in conflict is not necessarily part of the game of evolution. We didn't even evolve to be happy. You know, we evolved to pass on our genes. Very simple rule, okay? We may not like it, but that's just the fact, the way it happened. There's so much evidence points to it. So let's talk about what happens. Motivation, when you get more than one strong motivational state aroused at the same time, it happens all the time, in us and in animals. What are the various means that Lawrence describes? First, let's just name them. The first, superimposition. Just do both at the same time. If you've got the key stimuli, triggers two fixed action patterns, just do them both at once. That sometimes doesn't work very well. But that's one of the things that happen. What's another? What else can happen, yeah? Okay, one, in fact, we know that many of these inhibit each other, you know, and so only one of them can happen. Or in some cases, they alternate. Okay? What's another one? Yes? Yeah, sometimes if two are strong, the animal will actually do a third thing. That's called displacement activity. So let's... my last question there is, how is the conflict resolved or not? Well, it's not always resolved. Okay. It doesn't always resolve the conflict between the drives. But the animal will do something. Humans in conflict, what often happens? We don't do anything. It goes into our visceral nervous system and causes heart problems or whatever. Right? So we have to learn to deal with stress. Okay. I want an example of how superposition of approach and avoidance, fixed action patterns, occur. He gives beautiful examples of geese and fish, where it's so obvious that they are superimposing an approach response and an avoidance response, because geese move their necks differently and their heads differently when they're approaching and avoiding. And when you get two simultaneously happening, sometimes the animal's neck will literally vibrate. You know, it's so obvious that it's a conflict type of behavior. And ducks, some ducks do that too. So you get he calls it a violent trembling of the neck. He said it often occurs when you're trying to feed the goose and he wants the food, but he's afraid of you. Okay, so you'll get this combination. Some of you have known geese. You probably have seen that. I like the fish example even better. Certain cichlid or cichlid fish, so often studied by ethologists, when you get an aggressive response and a withdrawal response occurring simultaneously, you can get a fish that's sort of frozen in place, and the forward fins are moving back, and the back fins are moving forward. Literally, different parts of them are doing opposite things. It's very, very nice. Okay, so you can tell, if you know the fish behavior very well, you look at it and you can see the conflict immediately. Okay? Now, this is one that we'll need the picture for. Evidence that gestures of threat have originated from superpositions. And this is the picture. I want to make sure you understand. Okay? This is a dog. Could be a dog or a wolf. He deals with a dog here. And what he's shown, he's positioned them in with a calm dog here. And if we go this way, we've got increasing readiness to run away, to flee, okay? Probably if you've been around dogs, you know they will flatten their ears and their tail goes down between their legs and so forth, and their body gets lower and they'll slink away. But go across this way and you have increasing aggression, okay? With the ears forward, okay? And notice the change in the mouth. It begins here. Now he's opening, and we would also hear growling and so forth. Okay, increasing aggression. But now, what about these? What he's shown here is that you can interpret these gestures of the dog as combinations of these two, this and this. And you can place each of these on the graph. This one is the most obvious because the ears are back, as if he's withdrawing, and yet the mouth is that an aggressive dog. Okay. Some of the face is pulled into awkward positions as well. Okay. It's very clearly a combination of the two. Okay. And what's interesting is that in evolution, some of these expressions of conflict have evolved themselves because they serve as signals. In this case, they can serve as signals of threat. And we know that in many species of animals, social differences are not solved by actual fighting. It can happen. It's very rare for an animal to kill another member of the same species. Okay, because they respond to threats. And their threats can involve the whole body and can involve locomotion. And one of the animal will back down before the other one, and that solves the problem. Okay. In apes, when a challenger frequently will back down, but once in a while the challenger is confident. And it's rare that he will make a dominant animal actually back down. That does happen. And those are the situations that will result in a fight. Okay. But generally the fight will not result in death. One of them will clearly emerge as the stronger animal. And so then the expressions of the defeated animal will change. He becomes the more subordinate animal now in his gestures. Now, you mentioned about inhibition, and that's what I'm talking about here. Mutual inhibition usually occurs between action patterns at the same level of organization. It's in the Tinbergen diagram. So only one is expressed at any one time, but there are clear dominance relationships, especially with regard to what should always be dominant. If you're approaching a member of the opposite sex and you're really interested, what would happen to make you stop? It would probably make both animals stop.
If you thought something was threatening your life.
Exactly. A threat to life. Okay, so escape behavior is very dominant. And so if the hawk appears, you know, I mean, once in a while, animals can miss a predator in those situations, but usually they remain alert to predators for very good reason, because they won't live unless they can avoid the hawk if they're a small ground-living animal. Okay, so there are not just mutual inhibition, but in some cases the inhibition applies is very strong in one direction. And then I point out here, Lawrence points out that mutual inhibition can also cause oscillations between two fixed action patterns. And he points out that in evolution, these alternations can become ritualized. You see it especially in courtship behavior, because in courtship, animals that normally, when animals meet, they're animals of the same species, you know, don't get that close. They're in conflict all the time over food or over a nesting place, a resting place. Not just birds, but many species of animals. But you see, especially in birds, how conflict between approach and avoidance can become part of a mating ritual. And most mating rituals include this. Again, I have a videotape that shows one species of, I think, of a South American bird, very beautiful, brightly colored bird, that when it's courting is literally doing a dance on a branch, moving forward, looking like it's ready to attack, and jumping back, and it just looks like a beautiful dance as it's evolved. And those actions have changed a little bit in evolution, so it literally becomes a kind of dance. Okay, but you can, if you look at a lot of different species, in some of them it's much closer to the original approach and avoidance behaviors, and it's pretty obvious how it was derived in evolution. Okay, now the last one, displacement activities. He describes two situations in which displacement activities occur. And then I just want to mention this related concept. What are the two situations where an animal is likely to do a third thing? Or to get, and let's not define it that way, let's say to display an apparently irrelevant behavior pattern. Two situations. Well, give me one. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, like, give me, can you think of any examples? What might put an animal in that situation? Let's say an animal is hungry, he's approaching food. Then a social animal, like a monkey, and there's a very dominant animal standing nearby. Okay? That's going to put him in great conflict. He might just run away, but he might show displacement activity. And usually when it occurs, if it's between two specific drives, you'll generally get just one activity occurring. It's in all members of the species. It's very common to get that. He might start showing grooming behavior, for example. And what's interesting is that the drives, if the drives aroused are very strong, the displacement activity can discharge at such a high level that it might not look very normal at all. So for example, if I had hamsters in a little, they're not used to, they live in the ground. They don't live in wooden mazes that we make for them to study them in the laboratory. But I haven't always studied hamsters in dirt. I've studied them in mazes, I mean in boxes. And I was studying exploratory behavior, and I found it very common. They have a very high curiosity drive in response to novelty, so they would have a strong approach response to the novelty. but also a very strong fear response, because I had them in the day, in lighted rooms, and these are, remember, an evening animal. They're normally not used to being out in the open at all, or even in a tunnel-like situation. They're very afraid, and yet they also have this strong approach. And what do? They start showing violent grooming behavior. So they will be approaching, and they will stop, and they will be scratching themselves in a violent way, like they become just full of itches, you know. They will also sometimes, you will see mixed in, a tendency to mark with their flank glands the walls of the apparatus. And that could be aroused by the smell of another animal I had in there before, because they're solitary animals, living animals, and they do have territories. And what's interesting, of course, is that maybe this occurs because I've not given them any choice about it, but in fact they could just pull back and refuse to go, but they don't. You see mixtures of these behaviors. What are the two situations now? One is the one you said, and they want to do two things at the same time, and so they end up doing a third. The other is if one drive is highly aroused, but the stimulus needed to cause the action pattern is not there. So sometimes you will get displacement activity rather than in vacuo, the vacuum reaction. Sometimes you will get the third behavior. And some people say that's why we do art. It's really all based on sexual drive, right? I mean, that is one of the interpretations of human behavior patterns.
Jerry?
Yes? All right, let me see what I have left here. We already talked about this. No, I didn't, but this is just like the other things we mentioned. I'd like you to look at that in Lawrence, how displacement activities can become ritualized. This is your eighth question. Because again, the conflict can be become, the conflict situation can be signaled to other animals and can evolve, and he mentions that there. And he also just gives examples. He says that whenever he sees a certain two drives aroused in his geese, you know, it's always the same displacement activities he sees. We might show a little more variety, but what are common displacement activities in people? Scratching, grooming, you know, what am I doing now? Pacing, right? Locomotion is one of the most common displacement activities, are these multi-purpose actions like locomotion. Okay, now, rather than start the next lecture, I'm going to end here.